Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Wednesday, February the 17th, 2016, 1:15 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. You're tuned into the Now program here with Scott Spears. And momentarily, we're to be joined by Ben Cohen, co-founder of Ben & Jerry's Ice Cream, who is supposed to be joining us live from South Carolina, where he is supporting presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. So we'll learn all about that. And in the bottom of the hour, we're going to be joined by Derek Cressman. Derek Cressman is the author of a new book, When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and Selling of Democracy. And he's got some things to say about the passing of Chief Justice Scalia this past weekend and some other stuff. So this will be a political hour. And tomorrow, don't forget, February the 17th, coming up at 12:10, we'll be joined by Richard Gage, who is from the group Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. So that will be very interesting, and we will take your phone calls during that program. If you have any questions for Mr. Gage about 9/11, so stay tuned. That'll be February 17th at 12:10 p.m. We're going to take a quick break here and hopefully come with Ben Cohen from Ben & Jerry's right after this short break. Well, maybe we'll take it here in this short break. Here we go. Everybody's talking about Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 12:10, right here on WWGH Radio, from legendary comedian Kay Ballard, performing the fast food song.
Oh, there's one song that you like. I feel that, you know, fast foods have ruined the world.
Oh.
On the Champs-Élysées, on the Appian Way, there's McDonald's. By the Tomb of King Tut, there's a Chuck Full of Nuts and McDonald's. At La Scala, they sing by a big Burger King where the Styrofoam boxes go sweet. What's the use? What's the hell? I just heard Taco Bell went and franchised the wing at the Louvre. You know, I could go on and on and on, but that's it. I love things that are topical and that are kind of true.
The legendary actress and the voice of Ursula from The Little Mermaid, Pat Carroll.
What would we do without gossip, for heaven's sake, Scott? Oh, it's naughty, but it certainly fulfills a certain catty side of all of us. Oh, good Lord. When you think of the gossip sessions you've had with friends over the years, it's wonderful. It's like putting your hands in front of a lovely fire.
Do anything you want, Scott. You know I enjoy being on your show. Because well, just let me talking and I keep going.
It's Now with Scott Spears, Monday through Thursday, 12:10 to 2 p.m. right here on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com. Join me.
Hi, this is Steve Boom Boom Cannon, and as the king of trivia, I've got a question for you. Where can you find great talk, open phone lines, and celebrities every day? Now with Scott Spears, WGH Radio, 107.1 FM LP. We're in Marion, Ohio. Call him at 740-383-9944. Streaming live on the internet at www.wwgh1071.com.
From 12:10 to 2 p.m. Monday through Friday.
Scott Spears back with you on this Wednesday, February the 17th, 2016, 1:20 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, joined on the line by a gentleman who has authored a new book, When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and Selling of Democracy, Derek Cressman. Derek, how are you?
I'm great. It's good to be with you, Scott.
Absolutely. Now, tell me about the title of this book and where you're coming from.
Well, the concern is that when you look at our political campaigns these days and the information that voters have about candidates, you know, we're hearing the point of view from a handful of millionaires and billionaires because their money can talk. You know, their money buys TV ads for voters to listen to, and their money buys access so the politicians listen to them after the election. And that's no sane way to run a government of the people, by the people, and for the people.
How do you think it got this way?
Well, I guess the good news and the bad news is that this didn't just happen by accident, and it's not just inevitable that big money will always run our elections. It happened quite intentionally by a decision of the United States Supreme Court. It actually happened 40 years ago. You know, people are familiar with the more recent case of Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission that, you know, took things from bad to worse. But the real problem came 40 years ago when the United States Supreme Court gutted most of a law that Congress had passed in the wake of the Watergate scandal and Richard Nixon's huge campaign fundraising.
Now, do you think there's a way to turn this around?
I do, and you know, I think we may be at the beginning of that process. There are two things that you can do to overturn a misguided Supreme Court ruling. One is you can pass a constitutional amendment to overturn that court ruling, and Americans have actually done that 7 times before in our history. And the other thing that can happen is the composition of the court can change, and that can lead to the court reversing itself. And, you know, with the events of the weekend and Justice Scalia's departure from the Supreme Court, we're going to see a new Supreme Court. It's just a matter of when and how. But I think that creates an opportunity for the court to fix its own ways.
Well, speaking of the when and the how, that's kind of where we are right now. President Obama says he will nominate somebody. The Senate Republicans say they will not even take a look at it. What do you think will happen?
Well, I can't predict what will happen. I think it's appropriate for the Senate to nominate somebody for the court. I think it's appropriate for the Senate to then vote that person up or down, and then the people should vote the Senate up or down based on if they think they got that decision right. So in some ways, the timing of this vacancy will allow one way or the other the American people to weigh in on this issue of money in politics by voting for their U.S. senator, because I think a central issue in the November elections is going to be how did your senator vote or not vote or dodge a vote on a new Supreme Court nominee that could reverse this doctrine that, you know, campaign money is the same thing as free speech.
Do you think that Obama will get his choice through?
I have no idea, but I would be somewhat surprised. And in fact, I think it's conceivable that even the next president may not get their choice through. We're looking at a Congress that seems more interested in gridlock than it does in getting things done. And so we may actually see many members of Congress happy to let the court limp along with a 8-member court, rather than get it functioning as it should be. So I think it'll depend on the political judgment of the members of the Senate and whether or not they think voters will continue to tolerate gridlock or not, and that ultimately puts the ball back in our courts, which is where it should be.
So that being said, it's all a guess right now, how long do you think we will go without a fully functioning Supreme Court?
Well, I would guess certainly through this spring, and you know, I wouldn't be surprised if come September, Senator McConnell will make an assessment as to how likely it is that a Democrat will win the White House, how likely it is that his party will retain control of the Senate. And if he thinks it's likely that a Democrat will win anyhow and that he's likely to lose seats, he might very well decide to cut his losses and confirm a nominee at that point. If he thinks he can hold out and that either people are supporting his obstructionism or don't care about it, I think he could continue that. And if, you know, he retains control of the Senate, he could continue it up to 18 months from now. You know? So this is an interesting and potentially pivotal moment in U.S. history, and I think it remains to be seen how voters react to this almost a constitutional crisis between the executive branch and the legislative branch with the, you know, the future fate of the judicial branch hanging in the balance.
If we go into the fall, and let's say the Democrats do retain the White House with either Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, and by some way they take back the Senate, with Justice Scalia, by all accounts, being a very conservative justice, how would that change the Supreme Court? Does this help the campaign finance issue to be overturned?
Well, quite likely it does. Both Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton have pledged that if they're elected, they will not send a nominee to the Supreme Court who they aren't certain would reverse the Citizens United ruling and even the Buckley versus Valeo ruling 40 years ago that campaign money is free speech. And by replacing Scalia, who was a pro-big money vote, with someone that wanted limits on campaign spending, you would actually tilt the balance on the court from 5-4 opposing campaign finance rules to 5-4 supporting it. And if a new case then winds its way up to the Supreme Court, you could see a dramatic shift in the court's opinion on this. And I would certainly welcome that, but then the concern is that the court could always change back again. We're in this very delicate balance of 5-4 majorities and several members of the court more than 70 years in age. So it's a fragile moment in history.
Okay, money is free speech. At least five of the four justices believe that. So why is that from their point of view?
Well, from their point of view, they're saying, look, you can use money to buy advertisements to disseminate your political speech. And therefore, any limitations on that, they believe, is contrary to the First Amendment. But what that ignores is we actually limit the duration of anybody's actual speech all the time. You know, if you look at the floors of Congress, each member of Congress is limited to a couple of minutes when they're debating any particular bill. If you look at the United States Supreme Court itself, they limit each side in each case to usually 30 minutes in oral arguments. And so to say that, you know, we can limit real people's actual speech in order to have every voice heard and make wise decisions, but we can't limit the money that billionaires spend drowning out everybody else's voices with their 30-second TV ads, I just don't think stands up to intellectual muster, and 80% of the American public doesn't think it does either.
Now, I'm not really sure about this. I'm not sure how you could stop somebody from, if you're a private business person and you're not running for office and you're not affiliated with somebody's campaign, I'm not really sure what stops you from going to a radio, television, internet, whatever, outlet, newspaper, and buying as much time as you want. I guess what I don't understand about that is why do you not have to disclose where that money came from if you are the candidate, and why can't we limit the campaign contribution amount to a candidate? Why can't we cap that?
Well, actually, right now, we can and do limit the amount of a contribution to a candidate, but we don't limit the amount that goes to a so-called independent campaign. And we could limit that, and in fact we did for 40 years up until the Citizens United ruling undid that. And, you know, it's quite simple. You pass a law just like you pass a speed limit saying you can't go over the speed limit. You pass a law saying you can't contribute more than $5,000 or whatever the amount would be to buy an ad promoting or attacking a candidate for the U.S. Congress, and you enforce those laws the same way we enforce any other law. So we have had laws like that on the books. They have worked until the Supreme Court struck them down for their own ideological reasons.
Ideological reasons. What do you believe were their ideological reasons?
Well, I think you had five members of the Supreme Court, five up until Justice Scalia's death, now it's four, who essentially have, you know, drunk their own Kool-Aid, believing that wealth is an indicator of merit, and that therefore wealthy people should have a larger role and a larger say in our government, and anything that restricts that, they abhor. It's a pretty blatant power grab, in my view, and they were nominated to the court because they held those views, and it's led to a highly political and highly polarized Supreme Court, that is, I think, one of the main reasons we're going to see such a highly political and polarized confirmation process, is the stakes are now so high.
Well, it's kind of interesting because Hillary Clinton, and who knew this was going to happen to Justice Scalia, but Hillary Clinton said not too long ago after a meeting with President Obama, because President Obama will be a fairly young man when his term is up in 11 months, that she would nominate him to the Supreme Court. Now, I felt that was kind of an odd statement to make after their meeting, unless it had been talked about, and maybe that's something he would be interested in. Is that odd, or am I reading too much into that?
Well, perhaps I'm remembering it wrong, but I'd recalled that she was actually asked a question about whether or not she would nominate him, and she said, oh, that's an interesting idea. I didn't have the understanding that the two had had a conversation about it. I don't think it's unreasonable that a former president would be appointed to the Supreme Court, and in fact, I think one of the current problems with our Supreme Court is that none of the members, either on the left or the right, have any electoral experience or any experience in actually governing in the executive branch, and they're really quite out of touch with how things work in the real world and kind of, you know, squirreled away in their ivory towers. So having someone who'd been a governor, like Earl Warren, governor of California, who became Supreme Court Chief Justice, would be helpful. So I don't think it would be unusual for a president. I would be surprised if they'd had an explicit conversation about that, though.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure that they had a conversation, but and I'm not saying that came out right after the meeting, but I thought it was strange that they had a meeting, and President Obama has kind of said that he's more in favor with Hillary than he is with Bernie Sanders, and I thought when that question came up at a rally that she answered it that way. I thought, you know, all the time they've spent together, maybe there was a conversation at some point that maybe that's something he would like to do. Supreme Court nominations are for life or until they want to leave, so there wasn't even really an idea that she would have somebody to appoint. That might never have happened, but I just thought, do you think that's something President Obama might be highly interested in when he leaves? I can't see him just going and doing, you know, not much. I think he still wants to do things.
I think that's a reasonable guess. He taught constitutional law, I believe, prior to getting into politics. He's certainly very knowledgeable about the Constitution and the government of the United States. I, too, have a hard time imagining him just sort of riding off into the sunset and, relaxing in retirement. I expect he'll do something useful and in service to the country. Again, I have no idea. In fact, I thought I actually remembered a quote of him saying that he didn't think he'd be interested in that. But, you know, who knows? People have a way of changing their minds. So we'll see. It's certainly a wide open question right now, and that might be something that would weigh in the minds of Mitch McConnell and the Republicans in the Senate, is, you know, would we rather have Obama as the nominee on the Supreme Court, or would we rather have Obama?
Well, and that's what's going to be an interesting idea as this all comes about. Do you have anybody in your mind who would be a likely nominee that both sides would accept?
No, not right now that both sides would accept. I have seen, you know, there are lists of 10 or 20 names that may or may not be on the president's shortlist, and there's some speculation that some of the names on that list would be people who would not be inclined to overturn the Citizens United ruling. So that gives me some concern. But we're at a place where there's very little consensus in the U.S. Senate on anything. So I would be surprised if there is a nominee to the court that there is consensus on.
Why are we so gridlocked in this country? I mean, we have put women on the court. You know, Sandra Day O'Connor was appointed to the court, and she did not vote for everything that Ronald Reagan believed in. We now know that, I mean, a lot of talk in the last few days that Scalia was appointed under Ronald Reagan, and obviously he did believe a lot of the same things Reagan did, but Sandra Day O'Connor, not really the case.
Yeah, we're in a very polarized time in American politics, and we've seen other polarized times, like during the Great Depression, things were very polarized as well. I think part of it is that the Republican Party has moved significantly to the right, or at least many of their candidates have moved to the right due to primary challenges from Tea Party members and the Club for Growth. And so they've been very successful in moving their party to the right. And the Democrats have not responded by moving toward the center. They've responded more towards, you know, populist issues and pushing back on, you know, some of the economic warfare that we're seeing. So we're in a period of strong disagreement about, you know, are we going to run the country for the benefit of a wealthy few or for the benefit of everyone? And until somebody wins that argument, I expect there'll be strong disagreements in the Congress and on the court.
You know, when we get back to the Citizens United rule and what it has done. Now, since it has been in effect, we've had a few elections here. And in 2004, a lot of people thought Kerry was going to win. And a matter of fact, there were books written that Kerry did beat George W. Bush and something was tampered with in Ohio. 2008, Obama beat McCain, but McCain, you know, for some reason, the Republicans really did not get behind him. But when we go to 2012, Romney raised a lot more money. And this is the first time I think we really saw the money come into play and the Koch brothers become a national phenomenon. And Romney certainly had more money than the re-election campaign of Barack Obama, but it didn't work in his favor. And I think the Republicans this year are probably going to have more money for their candidate than the Democrats are. So that being said, does this really work? Dropping all this money, are people still going to believe what they're going to believe?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say that the money didn't work in Mitt Romney's favor. It just may not have done so enough. You know, I mean, big money in politics is a little bit like steroids in baseball. You know, you can't take a lousy baseball player and give them steroids and turn them into an all-star. You know, just look at Jeb Bush's results, you know, with the biggest super PAC in the history of the United States, and he's still performing pretty poorly. And likewise, even if you take a top-notch, you know, ball player or politician, you know, they're not going to win every race. They're not going to bat 1,000 if they're on steroids, but that doesn't mean that steroids has no effect, and it doesn't mean that it has a positive effect. It has a negative effect on the game in the same way that big money has a negative effect on politics that may or may not be able to overcome a certain candidate's weakness or a certain party's marginalization of themselves due to their stances on, you know, taxes or immigration or abortion or what have you that may be out of step with their constituents.
The Republicans will say that they are not the party for big business. They will say, just like the Democrats, that we want to help the middle class. That's what everybody says. That's what the debates say. That's what the campaign ads say. All the Republican candidates, we want to support the middle class. All the Republican candidates, we want to support the middle class. That being said, why is it that the richer people, the people with more money, always seem to spend more money with the Republicans than the Democrats?
Well, you know, there are certainly wealthy donors on both sides, but when you start looking at the billionaire class and corporate America, they do invest far more heavily in Republican candidates right now. And these are shrewd businessmen who believe that those candidates are more likely to deliver a political system and public policy that will benefit their interests. So I think that's a more useful indicator than candidates' rhetoric about who's going to support the middle class is, you know, who are the 1% investing in and what are they looking to get for a return on that investment?
That being said, I have one question before we part ways. And again, the book is When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and Selling of Democracy. Derek Cressman is the author. It's a great read. It sounds like a great read. And I even hate bringing this up, but all of a sudden it's becoming a big topic even in the mainstream media. Do you think there's any validity given to the fact that there might have been some foul play when it comes to the death of Justice Scalia?
I certainly have no reason to believe that, but, you know, I wasn't there in Texas, so I have no idea what happened. I don't think anybody does who wasn't there, so the speculation seems a little bit unwarranted. It certainly is not surprising to me that a 79-year-old man would have a heart attack and die in his sleep. So that on its face, it doesn't strike me as anything unusual, but it does speak to the very high stakes of power at the Supreme Court and, you know, the future of our country being at stake and as to whether or not this court is going to continue to rule that campaign money is free speech, or might they change that ruling and allow us to put some reasonable limits on big money in politics. That could determine the future of our elect for generations to come. And so there's going to be a lot of speculation perhaps about his death and a lot of arguments about his replacement.
I think, you know, when people are putting this stuff out that the family did not want an autopsy, that apparently they found him with a pillow on his head, that a lot of that he was declared dead over the telephone, just very bizarre stuff for a Supreme Court justice. You know, this isn't Joe Milligan from down the street.
Yeah, again, not having been at the ranch hunting that day, I have no basis to evaluate any of the wild stories that are running around on the internet and even in the mainstream media. So I have no reason to think that foul play was involved, but I can understand why people would be suspicious because the political stakes are so high.
Absolutely. Hey, thank you so much, Derek, for stopping by. It's been fun, and we'll definitely talk more because it's a big topic, and as the election heats up, who knows how much money is going to be spent.
That's right. It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. The guest has been Derek Cressman, author of the new book, When Money Talks, The High Price of Free Speech and Selling Democracy. We're going to take a quick break, hopefully come back with Ben Cohen here in just one moment. Don't you dare go anywhere.
Find yourself a chair. You're about to listen to the best show on the air. You'll love Charlie Evan. Can't wait to hear Scott Spears. You're Jerry Ann Michaels. Quite a lady, that's for sure. So listen to the Exchange Club for topics close to you. Discuss local topics, national topics too.
Alexander Hamilton is going off the $10 bill in 5 years. So long, Alexander. And he is going to put a woman on there on 2020 on the $10 bill. And this summer, they are going to poll people in the United States to see who should go on there. But it will be the first woman on the currency in like 120 years or something.
Well, the women that they've come up with wouldn't really make a bill very good looking. I mean, the women did a lot of good. I mean, don't get me wrong, but they're kind of...
Well, wait a second. What are you saying?
If they put somebody like Marilyn Monroe or something.
Go ahead and say it. You don't want Eleanor Roosevelt's mug on the $10 bill.
Well, and Rosa Parks, and who else?
Won't they airbrush them before they put them on the bill?
I mean, can you imagine flipping out a bill and there's a ugly face looking at you?
Now, wait a second.
Charlie.
Wait a second, Charlie.
Well, I think it's about time that a woman gets... on some
If they put somebody good looking on there.
Oh dear. Who?
Somebody that is famous. Somebody
they have to be dead.
Everything from drug lords and things that we can share. We'll even discuss the presidents and Hillary Clinton's hair.
What do you make of Trump, Charlie? You didn't jump in. You did the wife thing there, but
he's an egotistical jerk.
What do you really think about him?
But he knows enough to make millions. I guess we can't put him down for that.
We can't put him down
because we don't know how much he owes.
He would not have a chance. I'm sorry, at an office. I really now he's got a lot of money that
money.
He can put behind him. But how many people would vote for him? I don't think very many.
So stop. Listen and find yourself a chair. You're about to listen to the best show anywhere.
Every Friday, 12:10 until 1 p.m. Supported by Kroger, right here on WWGH 107.1 FM. Streaming live at WWGH1071.com.
Hey, Scott Spears back with you on this Wednesday, February 17th, 2016, 1:44 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, coming up on 1:45. And we're now going to hit the campaign trail because, as you know, all eyes are pointed on South Carolina. And we're joined by, actually, a very interesting gentleman who's down there campaigning for Bernie Sanders. He is Ben Cohen, co-founder of the famous, delicious ice cream company Ben and Jerry's. Ben of Ben and Jerry's, Ben Cohen, on the campaign trail in South Carolina. Ben, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good here, Scott. How about yourself?
Doing well. How is South Carolina right now?
Well, I tell you, weather-wise, the place is beautiful. You couldn't ask for more. I just came from a Bernie field office. The workers here, the volunteers, the staffers, they are psyched. They are way feeling the burn. And, you know, we're noticing, you know, the numbers for Bernie are moving up. You know, the amazing thing about Bernie, I know I'm here supporting him because I've been his constituent for 30 years. And I've seen the way he goes about government. And as far as I'm concerned, it's finally a candidate worth voting for. I mean, the guy is the real thing. He's honest. He can't be bought. He's got the interests of everyday Americans at heart. And, you know, he doesn't have as much name recognition as Hillary. So, you know, Hillary starts out ahead, but, you know, just like happened in Iowa and New Hampshire, things are starting to move here in South Carolina, and we hear Hillary's getting worried. I mean, because the main thing is that Bernie is talking to the real concerns of people, and he's talking about making the major changes in our country that are needed, and people really understand that.
You say you have been his constituent for many years in Vermont. What was the moment when you realized Bernie Sanders is not the typical politician?
Well, you know, when he first got elected mayor, you know, the local business establishment, the Old Boys Network, was just in the process of converting our waterfront on Lake Champlain from an industrial waterfront to one that would be privatized and being used for high-priced condominiums. And Bernie came up with this idea that we hadn't heard of before called public access. And he said that the waterfront of Burlington belongs to all the citizens of Burlington. And he fought the developers, and he won. He fought them all the way to the top court in Vermont, and today we have the most beautiful public waterfront that you could imagine. And I think that gives you an idea as to who he represents, who he has consistently stood for. And, you know, when he first ran for House, you know, everybody was saying the guy doesn't have a chance, he's never going to get elected, you know, the opposition was much more well-financed, and he won, and just about the first thing he did when he got elected was that he took a busload of people with cancer and senior citizens over the border into Canada so that they could get their prescription drugs for like one-tenth the price that they had to pay here in the U.S. So, you know, that's who he represents. He represents regular people, and he is willing to go up and fight Big Pharma. He's Wall Street, you know, because he's the only candidate who's not bought and paid for by Big Pharma and Wall Street.
Hillary Clinton continues to claim that she is not bought and paid for, that, Yes, she has received money from these groups, but they are not going to run her. What's your take on that?
You know, it just doesn't make sense, you know? I mean, we all know that you don't bite the hand that feeds you. You know, she has said that she's never changed a vote because of any of the millions of dollars that she's gotten from Wall Street or Big Pharma or the health insurance industry. And, you know, maybe that's true, but I can tell you that her views from the beginning to start out with have been shaped by that money. I mean, you know, I'm a business guy. I know that businesses don't go shelling out hundreds of thousands and millions of dollars and don't expect anything back.
When Bernie goes to, if he beats Hillary and he goes to the general election, how can he be elected in a country, number one, and nothing wrong with this, but he would be the first Jewish president. He would be the oldest president at 74 years old ever elected. And he also would be the first president that ever claimed they were a democratic socialist. Don't you think the Republicans are going to come after that hard?
You know, the Republicans, of course, are going to go hard after any democratic candidate. You know, they're certainly going to go really hard on Hillary, but the reality is that when you look at the polls that are showing potential matchups between potential Republican candidates and potential Democratic candidates, Bernie comes out ahead of Hillary. You know, the American public, I'm positive that the majority of the American public are not people who want Trump as our next president.
Do you think, and obviously you support him, but, and this is just an opinion floating around, that his toughest battle is going to be with Hillary. If he is able to beat Hillary, then if it is Trump, that might be a little easier, because the Republicans seem to be in a little disarray over there. But can he really beat Hillary? The polls that I saw last night on CNN in South Carolina, he's quite a ways back in South Carolina. Can he sustain the South if his momentum is hitting a wall after his big win in New Hampshire?
You know, Bernie has always been a come-from-behind candidate. He always comes from behind in the last, you know, few weeks of an election. So, I think he's got a good chance here in South Carolina. I certainly understand that he's behind right now, but if you look at the trend, he's moving up. As more and more people find out about Bernie and understand what he stands for, more and more people switch. And the other reality is that 40% of the people that are going to be voting in the primary are undecided at this time.
Do you think there could be a major divide in the Democratic Party if Bernie is the nominee, as this would be Hillary's second time where people kind of thought she was anointed and it didn't turn out that way?
Well, there's no doubt that the whole Democratic Party establishment is favoring Hillary. And that's the other amazing thing. I mean, I was in New Hampshire campaigning for Bernie, and I attended the huge statewide Democratic dinner, and there's every Democratic state party official, every local elected and state official getting up there talking about how they support Hillary. And despite the whole establishment being against him, he won by 20 points.
He did win big in New Hampshire. Ben, how close are you with Bernie? Are you a friend? Do you see him daily? Do you talk to him on the phone? What kind of relationship is it?
You know, we don't, like, go over each other's houses for dinner. We're friendly. When we run into each other on the street, we stop and talk. When we see each other at an airport, we stop and talk. I was honored when he called me up and asked me to help with his campaign, but, you know, it's not like we're social friends who go out and, I don't know, shoot pool or drink beer or whatever the hell it is friends do together.
What do you think it is about this man that appeals with the kids?
That he's talking real. He's not talking political speak. He's talking honest, like regular day-to-day people, and he's telling the truth. I mean, the reality is that our government is bought and paid for by corporations and the ultra-rich. Everybody knows it. It's just that Bernie's the only guy who's saying it. The saying, the system isn't broken, it's fixed, that really resonates with young people. They see it. I mean, you know, you learn one thing in school about justice and fairness and equality, and then you come into the outside world and you see the corruptness, the corrupt system that's happening, and then you've got, finally, a presidential candidate who's telling the truth and speaking out against this injustice and this corrupt system, and yeah, it's pretty attractive to young people. I don't know, it's pretty attractive to all my friends, and, you know, we're kind of old.
Well, for people who say, and this is the, these are the things that I've heard in the conversations we've had on air here, for people who say that he is too old, that he will not be able to get these things through Congress and the Senate, that Donald Trump is the entertainer right now and his polls are great and he won't be able to beat Trump, what do you say to that?
Well, for one thing, about the idea that he's too old, you know, people are living longer and longer. You know, what amazes, I mean, the guy is a very high energy dude. I mean, you know, Jerry and I go out on the campaign trail for him for like a week at a time, and we're totally beat. I mean, he's 10 years older than me. And, you know, he just keeps on going and going and going. The guy's like the Energizer Bunny. That's about the old thing. I mean, what is Hillary? What, 6 years younger? I mean, we're not talking big numbers here. What's the and what was the other question about
Trump? He wouldn't be able to beat Trump.
Oh well, you know, like I say, I mean, the polls show that he would absolutely beat Trump, and you know, I mean, there's one guy. I mean, Bernie is a serious candidate. I mean, you know, he's been in the House, he's been in the Senate. He knows what goes on in Washington, and that's why he's talking about the need for this political revolution. You know, I think Trump is just a bunch of bluster, and you know, I mean, he comes out with the most outrageous things that are going to be really harmful for our country.
Ben, I have to ask you, as we're nearing the end of this, how far will you go with this? Are you in for the long haul? Anytime Bernie wants you for the rest of this, you'll be out there?
You got it. Jerry and I are all in, all the way. Both feet, both arms, both scoops.
You did the Bernie Sanders ice cream. What is in that?
Bernie's Yearning is the name of the flavor, and it's a participatory flavor. You open up the pint, and underneath the lid is this huge disc of solid chocolate that covers the entire top of the container. And underneath is just plain mint ice cream. And the huge disc on top represents all the wealth that's gone to the top 1% since the end of the recession. And the way that you eat it is that you take a soup spoon and you whack it. You whack that chocolate disc up into a bunch of pieces, and then you mix it around in the ice cream, and there you have it, Bernie's Yearning.
Is this going to be available nationally?
No, I can tell you that the only pints that exist, there were only 40 of them that are made, are in my home freezer under lock and key. And we gave 25 of them to the Sanders campaign, as part of a promotion, and we're trying to figure out who to give the other ones to. But that's all we made, is just 40 pints.
You can always send one this way, Ben. what do you say to big people who are saying, well, this is Ben of Ben and Jerry's. This is a big business guy, and he's supporting Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why I'm supporting him is that the guy is actually fiscally responsible and fiscally conservative. You know, every one of the programs he's talking about, from free college education for public colleges and universities, to health care, to what else is he talking about? I don't know, but they all have a funding source. And for the education program, it's a small, less than 1% tax on financial transactions on Wall Street, speculative trades. Social Security gets financed by ending the cap at $250,000. You know, right now, people who earn over $250,000 don't pay any Social Security tax on the amount over that amount of money. And he's also talking about closing these corporate tax loopholes that allow corporations to, you know, set up some post office box and some overseas tax haven, and, you know, they end up getting away with not paying billions of dollars in taxes. So, you know, it's fiscally sound.
Ben, it's very interesting to talk to you. Keep on keeping on out there. And if you happen to talk to Bernie, you know, Super Tuesday's right around the corner. If he wants to stop by, we'll make a place for him.
Thanks a lot. I'll pass the word along.
Ben, if I were going to have an ice cream tonight, what's your favorite?
You know, lately I've been going back to the old classics. I like Chunky Monkey, which is banana ice cream with walnuts and chocolate chunks.
Sounds great. Thank you, Ben.
All right. Good talking to you.
Ben Cohen of Ben and Jerry's. That's all the time we have today. This is Scott Spears heading for the dugout.
The Hebrew said, I'm dreaming too. It's a dream that couldn't be sweeter. I seen you both go up to heaven, welcomed by St. Peter. I waited and waited and waited around, and oh, I got so lonely. I didn't think you was coming back. So I got up and I ate the bologna.
To legendary stand-up comic Marty Allen.
You know, Marty, one day we'll flip. You can host the show.
Oh, okay.
I think it would work okay. I think you could handle that.
Well, I'd love it. Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, we'll do
but
that.
But I'm not changing my name. It's going to be Marty Allen. I can't go on and say, I'm Marty Spears.
Legendary confetti-throwing comedian Rip Taylor.
Well, tell me about the sparkly jackets. Where did they come from?
Cleveland.
Okay.
Everything the ball and Mario.